Chapter 26. Safi. After I've shown the detectives out, I call Mum, but it goes straight to voicemail. I don't leave a message. She promised to ring me when she was on the way home, and it's not yet 5 p.m. I wonder if her lunch with Dad was productive, and if she managed to find out Alan Hartle's address. She did say she'd let me know her plans. Typical of my mum. She's so flighty, she probably hasn't even considered I'd like to know when she's coming back. I'm at my desk when a knock startles me. I go to the front door and peer through the glass. A smartly dressed woman in a polka dot blouse stands on the other side. I pull the door open a crack. Yes?
Saffron Cutler?
Yes.
Hello, my name is Nadia Barrows, and I'm from the Daily Mail. Would it be possible to...
I'm not interested. Please go away, I say firmly, closing the door before she can respond. I go back into my study. From the window, I can see a pack of about 5 reporters clustered together at the end of my driveway. Neil Lewisham's name must have been released already. They'll want to quiz me about Gran, I bet. There are no blinds or curtains at the study window. Can they see me? This is a nightmare. I don't want to have to be dealing with this on my own with Tom at work and Mum out of the house. I put my head in my hands and groan, nausea sweeping over me. I feel Snowy brush against my legs, and I bend down to pat his head. He can always sense when I'm stressed. My phone buzzes by my ear and I lift my head. A text from Dad flashes up on the screen.
Hi, sweetheart. I've emailed you the file on Sheila Watts. Saw your mum at lunch. She looked well. I have a couple of addresses for an Alan Hartle in Broadstairs, so she headed there. Kiss, kiss.
I don't reply. Instead, I click open my emails, suddenly filled with adrenaline. As promised, Dad has taken photos of the contents of Sheila Watts' file. There's not much. A few articles from various different regional newspapers in the Kent area about her drowning, and a few sheets of what looks like paper torn from a lined notepad. I can't make out the writing. It's all dots and symbols. I recognize it as shorthand. I've seen Dad use it when taking phone messages. I scroll down. The last photograph is of a press clipping from a national newspaper, the same one Dad works for. The piece was written in 1978 and isn't about Sheila, but a crime that dated back to the early 1950s. I scan it, not understanding the relevance. Maybe it was put into Sheila's file by mistake. I sit back in my chair, disappointed. There's nothing new here. Unless there's something in the shorthand notes. I'm just about to close the email when something about the last article catches my eye. The byline. I peer closer. The piece was written by a Neil Lewisham. I call Dad straight away. By the sound of the phones ringing in the background and the general hub of activity, I can tell he's still in the newsroom. I start to recount everything in fast, breathless sentences until Dad interrupts me to say he's just heard from a source. Of course he has.
Your gran could have been away when it happened,
he says.
Just because he died when she was living in the property doesn't mean she necessarily knew about it, not if she had a lodger.
I know. Weirdly, though, an article in the file you sent over is written by the same man, I say, goosebumps popping up along my arms when I think about it. It sounds like Neil Lewisham worked for the Mirror back in the late 1970s.
I thought the name sounded familiar, although he would have worked here well before my time. I'll see what I can find out. He might have been a freelancer. Is the article about Sheila?
No, it looks like some kind of roundup thing. It doesn't mention Sheila's name.
Oh, I say, suddenly remembering. Would you mind deciphering the shorthand in photo 4 for me?
Yes, I saw that. Unfortunately, it looks like Pittman. I can only do T-line shorthand, but I'll ask around. Some of the older guys here might know it.
Thanks, Dad. I feel a stab of remorse. I'm sorry to ask you for this. You must be shattered. When do you finish? I wish he'd find himself a nice girlfriend. I worry that he works too much.
You never have to be sorry to ask me for anything,
he says softly.
And I'll be leaving soon. Oh, and Saf, if you get any more bother from any reporters, just tell them you and Cutler at the Mirror is your dad. That'll shut them up.
I end the call feeling better. I stand up and glance out of the window, just in time to see the three remaining journalists walking off down the hill. I call Mum's mobile again, but there's no answer. It's the third time I've rung since the detectives left. Anxiety gnaws at my insides. She always picks up when I call. What if something's happened to her? What if she met up with an Alan Hartle and he's not an old man at all, but a psychopath? Mum is so gung-ho, she wouldn't think of the dangers. She believes she's invincible. Gran used to tell me stories of how Mum hitchhiked back from town when she was a teenager. And I know she was only telling me these things as a warning, to keep me safe. But she needn't have bothered. I would never have been so irresponsible. I leave a voicemail asking Mum to call me urgently, that I have news. But by 8 p.m, she still hasn't got in touch. The sun is going down, the remaining rays glinting through the woods out at the back. The inside of the cottage looks dark and gloomy, but it's too early to switch on the lights. Tom texts to say he's on the 1834 train, so he should be back here within the next half an hour. I go to the kitchen, make a red bush tea, and lean against the ugly kitchen units, comforted that I have Snowy, who has lain across my bare feet. I'm beginning to feel uneasy here now. That's the reality of it. Not just the bodies, although that's bad enough, but the private detective earlier, and his insistence that Gran has some kind of information that his client wants back. I've looked through Gran's boxes again, but there's nothing that would be important enough for someone to hire a private investigator. Gran. As he's got nothing from me, he might go to her. I slam down my mug so that liquid slops over the side onto the counter and retrieve my mobile from my pocket. I call the care home.
Elmbrook, Joy Robbins speaking.
Joy, hi, it's Safi here, Rose Gray's granddaughter.
Oh, hi, Safi. How are...
Has anyone tried to contact you about Gran? A Mr. Davies, perhaps?
No, I don't think so. Why?
I've had a few people asking for information on Gran. A man approached me saying he was a private detective, and I just wanted to make sure he didn't bother you or Gran, or come to the care home to visit her.
Oh, right. How strange. But don't worry,
she says, her clipped, curt voice reassuringly officious.
We don't let just anyone come in to visit.
Thanks. And would it be okay, if someone does turn up asking to see her, to contact me first?
Of course.
Thank you. Also, how is Gran? I'm coming to visit her tomorrow anyway, but...
She's fine. A bit confused today. She kept calling me Melissa.
Melissa? She laughs.
I must remind her of someone she once knew, that's all. A lot of the residents do it. See you tomorrow.
As I end the call, there is a bang at the front door, and I nearly drop my phone in fright. Then I hear the key in the lock, Tom's voice greeting Snowy, and I feel weak with relief. This is ridiculous. I'm a jittery mess. Being in the house alone all day has made me feel nervy. Tom still has his helmet on, which he looks faintly ridiculous in,
and his expression changes to shock when I hurtle into his arms.
Hey, what's wrong?
I lead him into the living room. He perches on the sofa to take off his helmet. His hair is plastered to his head. He watches me without speaking while I pace the room, the words falling fast from my mouth. When I finished, he stares at me, his eyes flashing furiously.
Who the fuck does this Davies bloke think he is? I could kill him.
Tom, how dare he frighten you like that? I'm more concerned about who he's working for. He wouldn't tell me what kind of information Gran is supposed to have. I sigh. I don't know. It just feels like it's snowballing. Something bigger is going on here. Are we just blundering on, getting ourselves deeper in the shit without knowing the full picture? And now Mum has gone tearing off to fucking Broadstairs to meet a man who may or may not be the real Alan Hartle, and I haven't heard from her, and our back garden is a crime scene, and don't get me started on those journalists. I can't step out of the front door without being accosted. I feel like I'm under house arrest. I'm out of breath after my rant and sink onto the sofa next to him, my head in my hands, my shoulders shuddering.
I wish we'd stayed in Croydon,
I say, through my fingers, tears falling down my cheeks and plopping onto my jeans.
I'm sick of it all, Tom. This was supposed to be a new start for us, for the baby. I don't even want to go in the little bedroom anymore, knowing it looks out onto the garden, seeing that hole where those bodies were.
Tom pulls me against him, the cool leather of his jacket pressing against my cheek.
I'm going to take a sickie tomorrow. I'm not leaving you here alone.
I sit up in shock. Tom has never once taken a day off work sick. Not even when he had food poisoning and had to take a sick bag on the tube with him.
Tom, you can't.
I think I'm owed it, don't you? And I don't want you to be alone tomorrow. I can get on with decorating. And I'll call the builders, find out when they can come back, and continue the build. If they mess us around again, we'll get someone else. Then we won't have to look at the hole anymore.
Mum should be back. The thought of Mum makes me feel queasy with worry again. What time is it? Tom checks his watch.
Just gone 8:30.
He stands up, shrugging off his jacket.
It's not like Lorna to forget to call, is it? She's usually always attached to that phone.
I know, I say, picking up my mobile and trying her number again. It goes straight to voicemail. By 10 o'clock, she's still not home. Every time I hear a car, which isn't often, I run to the window, hoping it's a taxi, but nothing. Do you think I should call the police? I say to Tom, who's sitting in front of the television watching The Wire on box set, although neither of us can concentrate.
The police won't do anything. Haven't you got to wait 24 hours or something before they'll look into an adult's disappearance?
I take a deep breath, pushing down panic. I don't know what to do with myself. My body oozes with nervous energy. I know Mum is a free spirit, and I never worry about her when she's in Spain. But something doesn't feel right about this. I know she would have rung me. After all, this is a journey we're on together. I pull back the grey-flowered curtains that we'd taken from our Croydon flat and don't quite fit the window. It's dark outside. There isn't even a street lamp to light the way. The moon, a sliver of a crescent in the sky, half obscured by a cloud. The night seems heavy and oppressive, like a thick blanket curling around my car and Tom's bike, making innocuous shapes menacing.
Come away from the window, says Tom gently. I'm sure she's okay.
Then why wouldn't she have phoned? I wail, my hands clenched by my sides. I can't shake the feeling that something bad has happened to her. Something that's connected to all this. What have we got involved in?
Chapter 27. Lorna. Lorna finds herself a window seat on the train back to London, clutching her caramel macchiato, grateful that nobody has occupied the space next to her so she can stretch out. She's shattered and a little tipsy. She shouldn't have had that last glass of wine. Now it's gone 8, and she still has to get from London to Chippenham. She leans her head against the glass as the train pulls out of the station, watching the sun cast purple and peach streaks across the sky, reflecting on her conversation with Alan and her suspicions that Daphne and Sheila are the same person. She can't wait to tell Safi. She sits up straighter. Safi? She hasn't called her all day. Damn it, she'd promised she'd ring on her way home. She rummages in her bag for her phone. Where is it? She has so much crap in her bag. Old receipts, business cards, a notebook, 2 pens, her purse and makeup. But it doesn't matter how much she searches. It's not there. She flops back against the seat. She must have dropped it. Or did she leave it on the table when she left? She groans, startling a man in the seat opposite. Her whole life is on that phone. She doesn't know any of the numbers by heart. Who does anymore? She suddenly feels naked and vulnerable without it, and inwardly curses the modern world. The advances in technology that have made her so dependent on a stupid little machine. She fights the urge to scream. What is she going to do now? She just hopes there's a taxi rank outside the station in Chippenham, or she'll have a long walk back to Beggar's Nook. It's at least 5 miles, and without her phone, she won't know the way. There's nothing she can do about it now, anyway, she thinks, as she watches the Kent countryside whiz past her. She has no choice but to drink her coffee and try to relax. It's gone 11 by the time her second train pulls into Chippenham Station. She hopes Safi and Tom aren't too worried about her. She feels a stab of guilt that she's probably keeping them up because she hasn't got her own key. The station is deserted. The other 3 passengers who disembarked with her have melted away into the dark night. She shivers in her tweed jacket and pulls it around herself, aware of her heels echoing on the empty platform. She walks fast, wanting to get home now, back to Safi, to tell her everything she's found out today. At the entrance, there are no waiting taxis. Just an empty strip of road. What is she going to do now? Could she ask to borrow someone's phone? A young guy she recognizes from the train is waiting by the exit, a briefcase at his feet, headphones on and red Nike trainers, at odds with his business suit. His head is bent as he scrolls through his phone. She sidles up to him, aware she must look a bit manic. He removes his headphones as she gets closer.
Excuse me, can I use your phone to call a taxi?
Sure, he says, without smiling. I'll call one. I've got a number in my phone. Where do you want to go?
Beggar's Nook.
He laughs. Beggar's Nook? What the hell is that? She forces a smile.
It's a little village nearby.
He calls the taxi firm, then places his hand over the mouthpiece.
Name?
He whispers.
Lorna,
she whispers back, not sure why she's whispering too. He gives her a strange look. It will be with you in 10, he says, as he ends the call.
Thank you, I'm so grateful.
Got to go, mine lives here, he says, jogging towards a Fiesta that has just pulled up. She watches his car drive off, aware she's completely alone now. Thankfully, she doesn't have to wait long before the taxi arrives. She sinks into the back seat with relief. It takes just 15 minutes to get to Beggar's Nook.
What number?
He asks, as he drives through the village towards Safi's cottage.
9 Skelton Place, just up here somewhere, she says, waving vaguely.
She can't remember exactly where it is on this hill. She pays and gets out, the taxi driving off into the distance, the rear lights winking, then disappearing as it rounds the bend, leaving her in total darkness. She feels she's being swallowed by it. Why are there no street lamps? She begins walking up the hill. Yes, it's not far, she tells herself. There's the lane that leads to the woods and the postbox. It's 2 houses up from that. She hears footsteps behind her, and the back of her neck prickles. There was nobody around when she got out of the taxi. It happens so quickly. A hand reaching from behind and over her mouth. Another arm clamping her chest like a steel safety bar on a fairground ride. And she's thinking that this can't be happening in a little rural village like Beggar's Nook. She can't even scream. His hand is pressed down too firmly on her face. She tries to kick out, but his arm tightens so that she can barely breathe. He drags her backwards towards the lane, towards the woods. She tries to fight against it, to dig her heels into the pavement, but he's too strong. The heel on her sandal snaps and comes off. She's so frightened she wants to pee. Stay calm, she tells herself. Stay calm, stay calm. They're in the lane now, between 2 houses hidden behind high hedges. Nobody will be able to see her.
Listen,
he growls, his breath hot against her ear.
If you do what I say, I won't hurt you.
He's going to rape me, she thinks. As long as he doesn't kill me, don't kill me.
She silently pleads. She can't leave Safi. She's about to be a grandmother.
I need information on Rose Grey.
She's so shocked that for an instant she forgets to be frightened. This isn't some random attack. He knows her mother. She recognizes his voice. She can only nod.
You need to ask her where she's buried the evidence. It's important. If you don't ask her, I'll hurt your daughter.
Oh, God, not Safi, no.
Anything,
she mumbles against his palm.
I'm going to take my hand away now. If you scream, I'll come back. If you go to the police, I'll know. And you don't want me to pay Rose a little visit now, do you? I know where her care home is.
Blood pounds in her ears, but she nods. He removes his hand from her mouth, but he still clamps her from behind with his arm, so she can't see his face.
I need your phone number, he says.
I've lost my phone.
A likely story.
She wants to cry.
I have. You can check my bag.
It's still on her shoulder, pinned there by the weight of him.
Then ring the number on the card. Your daughter will know which card.
He releases her so hard that she falls forward, her knees crashing against the pavement, and she cries out in pain. She hears his retreating footsteps heading down the lane towards the woods. But she doesn't dare turn around until he's gone. She gets to her feet. Her legs are like jelly, and there is a hole in the knee of her jeans, blood and grit darkening the edges.
She hobbles out of the lane and turns left, stopping to pick up her broken heel on the way. She's trembling all over. The bushes and hedges that obscure the other properties would also hide crime, she thinks, as she limps home. She could have been raped and murdered right here on this street, and nobody would have seen a thing. She's relieved when she spots number 9, the light in the living room still on, seeping through the ill-fitting curtains at the window. She hobbles over the drive, her unheeled shoes sinking into the gravel. Before she's even got to the door, it's thrown open, her daughter standing there, a mixture of horror and relief on her face.
Mum!
She cries, throwing herself at her.
Oh my God, we've been so worried. Are you okay? What's happened?
She manages to nod as Safi ushers her into the house and onto the sofa. Tom is standing by the fireplace, and the look on his face when he sees her is so horrified that she fights the urge to laugh hysterically.
He grabbed me, she says. This fucking bastard grabbed me. He must have been waiting. I lost my phone. I'm so sorry I didn't call. Oh my God, don't worry about that now, says Safi, sitting next to her and taking her hand. Your knee is bleeding. Are you okay? Who grabbed you?
I think it was the same guy from yesterday. Glenn, he said his name was. Safi frowns.
From yesterday?
She swallows tears. She can't cry. She has to be strong for her daughter, who looks petrified. He stopped me when I was taking Snowy for a walk. Seemed pleasant enough. But as I was walking away, I heard him say something about your gran. I thought I'd misheard him, but...
Tom starts pacing. This is fucking unbelievable. We need to call the police. Safi, what's the number for DS Barnes?
He's already got his mobile in his hand.
No,
cries Lorna, standing up. She wobbles on her one heel and has to sit down again. Her nail varnish has chipped and her feet are dirty.
We can't contact the police. He said he'll know. He said he knows where your gran is living.
Lorna tells them everything. Almost everything, anyway. She omits the part where he threatened to hurt Safi. She doesn't want to scare her any more than she needs to. All this stress and worry can't be good for the baby.
He said something about Gran burying the evidence, and that he wanted to know where.
The evidence? Safi's face pales.
Is that what he said? Paperwork that Gran has? I don't know. I don't think he mentioned paperwork, but I can't remember. He wanted me to ask your gran. He mentioned a card, says Lorna. I didn't know what he was talking about.
Safi inhales sharply.
That wanker! It's the same guy!
What do you mean?
I met someone earlier. He said he was a private detective and he'd been hired by someone to find a file or paperwork or something that Gran has. He tried to be all nice at first, but I was feeling increasingly uneasy as the conversation progressed.
She shudders.
He was quite intense. I felt afraid by the end. As he was leaving, he gave me his card. It said G.E. Davies. Glenn, it's got to be the same man.
She goes to the coffee table and picks something up.
Here,
she says, handing it to Lorna.
He can't be a legitimate private detective, says Tom, still pacing. Not if he's grabbing women in the street.
Lorna takes the card from her daughter. It looks crude and unprofessionally done. She hands it back.
He specifically said evidence.
Safi pulls at her hair, looking stressed.
The police came today, she says. And Lorna listens as her daughter tells her about their visit. When they were leaving, I gave them Davy's number, and they said they'd check him out. We should tell them about this too. Lorna can't take it all in. Finding out her mother lived here when at least one of the murders took place. And now this. It must be connected somehow. She bends over and takes off her shoes. She'll have to see if she can glue the heel back on. What the hell was Rose mixed up in? Tom stops pacing, his arms folded, fixing Lorna with a furious gaze, like it's her fault. She's the parent here. She needs to take charge. Let's all go to bed, she says, standing up. I'll come with you to the care home tomorrow, honey. See what we can find out. Mum. Lorna holds up her hand, looking from Safi's anxious face to Tom's angry one. You both need to get some rest, she says, in her most authoritarian voice. We'll talk about it tomorrow. She limps out of the room and climbs the stairs, her knee aching with the movement. Fury builds inside her. How dare this man threaten her family? Tomorrow, she thinks, she'll buy some panic alarms and some pepper spray. If that man comes anywhere near her daughter again, she'll kill him. Chapter 28, Rose. February 1980. The day after I ran into Joel in the village square, the snow came. He woke me up, scrambling into my room and jumping on my bed, an angel in your long white nightie. Snow! Snow! You cried, shaking me awake and dragging me to the window, the wooden floorboards cold underfoot. You look so cute, your big brown eyes wide with delight, and your hair in dark tendrils around your shoulders. Thick, dense flakes were falling fast and settling onto the layer already on the ground. The sky was a perfect pearly white and gave the impression the world was wrapped in a quilt. No play school today. I'm not going out in this, I said, climbing back into bed and snuggling down. You clapped your hands excitedly. Snowman! Yes, snowman. But later. Daphne appeared at the bedroom door then, dressed in many layers with thick socks pulled up over pyjama bottoms, which ballooned over the top, giving the impression she was wearing old-fashioned breeches. Her long, fair hair was a messy halo around her face. It's bloody freezing, she said, blowing theatrically onto her hands. Snow! Snow! You sang, grabbing her hands, pulling her around like you were playing a game of Ring of Roses. Daphne threw her head back and laughed. And as I watched the two of you, I felt my heart burst with happiness. The three of us, in that little cottage, cozy and safe, cocooned from the world. We didn't need anybody else. We lit the fire in the front room, and Daphne made hot chocolate, heating milk on the stove, while I rummaged in cupboards, making sure we had enough food for the next few days, just in case we couldn't get to the shops. I bought most of my food in the grocery store, but once a month I was forced to drive to the big Safeway on the roundabout, 2 miles or so out of the village. Luckily, I'd only gone the week before. We've got lots of tins of beans and spaghetti hoops, I announced. And I froze some bread yesterday. We've still got batches of my homemade soup, Daphne said, handing me a mug of hot chocolate. You were already sitting at the kitchen table, slurping yours noisily, your little legs swinging. Under your nightie, I could see you'd pulled your bright yellow wellies onto the wrong feet. Lolly, sweetheart. You need to get dressed before we can go outside. Daffy, you said, standing up. You're a big girl now. You can get dressed by yourself, I said, rolling my eyes at Daphne. but she flashed you a beatific smile.
Of course I'll help, she said, taking your hand. Come on, Princess Lollipop. Let's find lots of warm clothes to put on.
She always called you Princess Lollipop, and you loved it.
You loved her.
Daphne spent hours with you that day, building a snowman in the garden. I watched for a bit out of the window, laughing with you both every time the head fell off, which it did, often.
It's harder than it looks, mouthed Daphne.
The snow continued to fall onto your hats, lingering on your hair so that it looked like tiny white flowers were entwined in your plaits. Bracing myself, I reluctantly went outside too. I hated the cold, but Daphne didn't seem to feel it, and neither did you, even though your mittens were sopping wet and your nose and cheeks red. By now, the snow was nearly up to the top of your wellies. Daphne didn't own a pair, so she was wearing her tatty platform boots, which didn't look very waterproof.
We just need to find some currants and a carrot for the eyes and nose, she said to you once she'd finished,
standing up, hands on hips, to admire her handiwork. You ran inside, finally emerging triumphantly with a small shriveled carrot and two fat sultanas.
You both look frozen to the bones, I said.
The snow had slowed now, only the occasional flake floating to the ground.
Come on, I'll make beans on toast.
Later, while you played with your teddies in your bedroom, Daphne and I sat with a cup of tea by the fire, her fingers still red raw from the cold. She stretched out her legs on the sofa, resting her feet in my lap. I stiffened, embarrassed at her familiarity. Daphne, however, was totally unselfconscious.
Tuck your legs up here, she said, tapping my ankle.
I hesitated, then swung my legs up so that my feet rested against her thigh.
See? That's more comfortable, isn't it?
I smiled back. It was. It felt like the kind of thing you'd do with a sister, that's all. Completely natural. I didn't need to feel awkward about it. I relaxed into the position, smiling at her over my mug. I had known Daphne less than 2 months, but she had effortlessly blended into our lives. And now, here we were, at ease with each other. We could sit in companionable silence, not feeling the other had to talk. We seemed to know what the other was thinking or feeling, and acted accordingly. I suddenly realized that she never annoyed me. She was interesting and clever and independent and fun. She was kind and thoughtful, the way she played with you and knitted outfits for your teddies and dolls, or brought back little gifts, like your favourite sponge cake or fir cones from the woods that she sprayed silver and placed on the windowsill. She spent hours bent over her sewing machine to make you clothes. Last week, she turned up with a Swiss cheese plant that was so big it obscured her head as she carried it through the door. It now sat in the corner by the fireplace. I didn't have the heart to tell her I was terrible with plants. They almost always died on my watch. Do you have any sisters? I asked, forgetting our rule of no questions. I felt her stiffen, but she shook her head, much to my surprise.
No.
Me neither. And your parents? Daphne sipped her drink. The fire crackled in the hearth. All I knew about her was that she'd grown up in South London, not that far from where I'd lived with my parents, but moved away when she was 11. Since then, she said, she'd lived all over. She shook her head.
Long, boring story. I'm the black sheep. You know how it is.
I didn't, but I nodded anyway.
She turned away from me, not saying anything else, just staring into the fire, her eyes huge and sad. After a few minutes, she fixed her eyes on me again, something changing in her expression. I've always kept myself to myself. Other places I've stayed, other people I've lodged with, I've kept at arm's length. But you... Her eyes softened. You're the only person I've let myself get close to, Rose. For a long, long time. I hope you don't make me regret it. I felt myself blush. Of course I won't. But can I ask, why me? I don't know. I feel like we're the same. She was right. I felt that too. Both self-sufficient, determined to be strong, but also damaged. She was the first person I had let myself grow close to since I'd run away that terrible night 3 years ago. And I got the feeling it was the same for Daphne. As an only child, I'd never known what it was like to have a sibling, but the closeness I felt with Daphne in that moment was how I'd always imagined it would be. I glanced at her, and her eyes locked with mine. My stomach fluttered. I felt more for her than sisterly affection. I knew that, really. The more I got to know her, the deeper my feelings became. I felt my cheeks grow hot at the thought that she might be able to tell. She smiled at me. And also, with Lolly. With the three of us, it's like the family I wish I'd had. Me too, I said, my voice full of emotion. We smiled at each other shyly, and she reached over and took my hand in hers, squeezing my fingers gently. In that moment, I knew I'd do anything for her. I wanted to look out for her and protect her. I'd never felt that way about another person, apart from you, and maybe Audrey. Looking back now, I realised I was falling in love. Then you came bounding into the room with a Barbie half-dressed. You thrust it into Daphne's lap. I can't do, you wailed. And Daphne laughed and pulled you onto her legs while she dressed the doll for you. It was the most perfect day. The three of us huddled on the sofa, happy and safe, the fire roaring and the snow falling softly outside. I wish we could have stayed that way. I really do. Part 3.
Chapter 29. Theo. On Thursday morning, Theo unexpectedly finds himself alone in his dad's study, and an opportunity presents itself to him that's too good to pass up. The chance to snoop. It's not the kind of behaviour Theo has ever indulged in before. He's not the type. He's never looked through Jen's phone or tried to hack into her emails, like some of his mates have done with their other halves. Mutual trust is so important to him. And he knows Jen feels the same. My dad is a potential pervert who is hiding something, he tells himself in a bid to ease his conscience. Theo hadn't planned to go to his dad's today, especially after his visit to Larry yesterday. But guilt had gnawed at him about their argument, and even though he'd lain awake most of the night, fury and disappointment grappling for prime emotion, guilt still found a way of slipping in, like a piece of shell falling into a bowl when cracking an egg. Jen had given him a knowing smile when he said he was popping over to his dad's before work. He's still your dad, she said softly, before kissing him goodbye. But when he arrived, there was no answer. Just Mavis, the housekeeper, on her way out. He's at the golf club, she'd said. He won't be back until later. Theo had held up his backpack. I've got food for him, he lied. Don't worry, You go, and I'll let myself out. You're a good son, she said, patting his cheek fondly, then scuttling off down the driveway to catch her bus. Now, standing in his father's study, he feels like the worst son in the world. Even as a kid, he knew never to come in here without his dad's permission. It was off limits, and a fate worse than death if he ever dared defy his father's orders. Not that he ever did. He hadn't been interested as a boy. It was full of his father's boring work stuff and ugly golfing trophies. But now his heart beats with anticipation. His dad refuses to tell him anything, yet he knows this room must be a vault for his many secrets. Theo glances around the study, at the wood panelling on the walls, the built-in shelves and display cabinet, the desk with its dark green padded insert. Where to start? What to look for? It smells in here. A musky, expensive scent mixed with polished wood. It's ludicrous, really, but Theo's always felt his dad just smells important. He goes to the built-in bookshelves on the far wall behind the desk. Underneath the shelves on either side, there is a set of cupboard doors. The same cupboards his dad had been rummaging through last week when he was in one of his tempers. Theo bends down and pulls open one of the doors. Neatly stacked is a pile of lever-arch folders. He pulls one out and skims through the pages. It looks like old tax accounts. He shoves them back, making sure to keep them in the right order. He's certain that's the kind of thing his dad would notice. He tries the other cupboard, but it's locked. Damn it. He didn't even think about that. Why would his dad lock it unless it was something he didn't want anyone seeing? Maybe it isn't even allowed in here to clean. He tries the desk drawers instead. Surprisingly, they aren't locked, but they contain nothing exciting. Just some receipts held together with a bulldog clip, a pack of Bic pens, a fancy fountain pen, some certificates from the golf club, and a bottle of pills. He picks them up, examining the label. Blood pressure medication. He didn't even know his dad had high blood pressure. He replaces the bottle. There must be something, he thinks, his eye going again to the locked cupboard. He has to get in there, whatever the consequences. He opens the desk drawer again and finds two large paper clips, which he bends into a V, shoving the end of one into the lock. He'd tried this once with a bunch of mates years ago at school, trying to get into the display cabinet that held all the sporting medals. They wanted to play a prank on one of the rugby team. He remembers having to push down on the end of one while jiggling the other. Come on, you piece of shit, open, he says through clenched teeth. Finally, he hears a pop and feels a release, and the cupboard springs open. He sits back on his heels, shocked that he's actually managed to do it. And then his heart falls. The cupboard is empty. All that effort, and his dad has locked a fucking empty cupboard. He looks around as though this is some prank, and his dad is at the door laughing at him. But no, he's alone. Why would his dad lock an empty cupboard? Unless, he thinks, gathering his thoughts, his dad has moved whatever was in there to somewhere more secure. He peers into the cupboard, gently pushing on the shelves within. The bottom one creaks under his hand. He inspects it more closely. It's loose, more like a panel than a shelf. He pushes it, and the top comes off, revealing a sort of hidden section underneath. Theo's heart pounds. Something's there. A small pile of newspaper cuttings with a black A4 flexible folder placed on top. He reaches for the cuttings. They're all dated from 2004 and are from local newspapers about his mum's accident. He understands why his dad might want to keep them, but why hide them? Perhaps he just forgot about them, he thinks, putting them back. Then he turns to the folder. It has clear plastic sleeves. He flicks through it. Each of the 15-odd sleeves has a photograph loose at the bottom. Nothing more than that. He takes out the first. It's in colour, muted, autumnal tones, and is of a woman around his age. It looks like she's unaware the photo has been taken. She's heavily pregnant. By the style of her hair and clothes, it looks to be from the late 1960s or early 1970s. He turns the photograph over, expecting maybe a date or a name, but it's blank. He flicks through the rest of the folder, and it's the same. Photographs of women taken unawares. But nothing else. The latest photo looks more recent. Maybe 10 years ago. 15 at a push. Definitely the 21st century. Why has his dad got a folder of these random women? An appalling thought suddenly hits Theo. Perhaps his dad molested them and now has become obsessed with them, stalking them. A myriad different hideous scenarios flits through his mind, like a storyboard for a horror film, and he snaps the folder shut. No, he reasons, that can't be it. If his dad was a serial sex offender, wouldn't at least some of these women have come forward and made a complaint? As far as he's aware, nobody has, apart from Cynthia Parsons. He wonders if one of the women was her. He opens the folder again and goes back to the first photo. If only he had some other names to go by. He reaches for his phone in his back pocket and he's not sure why, but he takes snaps of the first five photos. The crunching sound of gravel under tyres makes him jump and he stands up to look out the study window. His dad is pulling his Mercedes onto the driveway next to his old Volvo. Bollocks. He thought he had more time. His dad will see his car and know he's there, in the house, alone. Something he hasn't done since moving out properly after university. He shoves the folder back on top of the newspaper cuttings and drops the shelf on top, slamming the cupboard door shut, his heart hammering so hard he can feel the pound of it in his ears. He dreads to think how apoplectic his dad will be if he catches him in his study. He tries to relock the cupboard, but no amount of wriggling of the paperclip works. Sweat breaks out on his forehead. He has no choice but to leave it and hope his dad thinks he just forgot to lock it. He goes to the window again. His dad standing in the driveway frowning at Theo's car, his hand stroking the back of his head. Then he looks up at his study and Theo has to duck. Shit. Was he seen? He crawls on his hands and knees away from the window and exits the study, running down the elaborate staircase. His train is squeaking on the parquet as he races into the kitchen. He can hear his dad's key in the lock. Theo grabs himself a glass of water and sits at the island, trying to catch his breath and make it look like he's been sitting there the whole time. The soles of his dad's expensive brogues echo in the hallway. And then he's there, filling the doorway, all 6'3" of him. What are you doing here? He growls. Mavis, let me in. I wanted to see you. To apologise for the other day. His dad eyes him warily, as though unsure whether to believe him. She told me you'd be back soon. The lie slips surprisingly easily from Theo's tongue, but he blushes anyway, like he used to do at school when he was caught out by a teacher. His dad goes over to the kettle and switches it on. He looks tired. There are new lines under his eyes, and he places both hands on his lower back and does a kind of stretch. You all right for food? Asks Theo. Of course I am. I'm a grown man. I can look after myself. I did do national service. Christ, thinks Theo, mentally rolling his eyes. Not that old chestnut. His father had been in the last cohort to do national service, and growing up, he never let Theo forget it. He watches as his dad makes himself a cup of tea. His tanned arms are sinewy in his polo shirt. He's always felt he knew just the kind of man his father was. Strict, old-fashioned, brilliant, old money, educated and controlling. But not a pervert. Or a stalker. Or a psychopath. Are you those things, Dad? He silently asks. Theo wonders, as he surveys him pressing his tea bag against his mug, whether he has ever loved his father. He'd pitied him, yeah, felt a sense of duty towards him, felt responsible for him after his mother died. But love, he's not sure. Maybe when he was a kid, when he was still full of hope that his dad might care about him, become the father he'd always wished for. He realises, with a jolt, that he doesn't like his dad. He's cold and he's hard and Theo is fed up with trying to make excuses for him in his own mind. He could walk out of here now and not look back. And if it wasn't for the fact that he'd worry his mum would be disappointed in him, then he would. He He doubts his dad would give a shit if he never visited again. Right, says Theo, jumping down from the bar stool. I'm off. His dad turns to him, surprise on his face. You don't want a cup of tea? But he hesitates. Does his dad want him to stay? He's as hard to read as a stone statue. Is it a peace offering? And then he remembers Larry's words. The complaint of sexual misconduct by Cynthia Parsons. He remembers his mother's red eyes and the bruises she hid. He remembers how he'd cowered as a kid when his dad was in one of his ranting moods. But then he looks into his father's blue eyes, the whites of which are yellowing with age, and he feels a twinge of compassion. He's an old man. He's probably lonely. Go on then, he finds himself saying.
Chapter 30. Safi. Tom pulls a sickie the next morning, like he promised last night, even though I tell him there's no need. I just want to make sure he doesn't come back, he says over breakfast. It's raining, for the first time in weeks, and the cottage feels cold and damp. The windows need replacing, not that we can think of that at the moment with everything else going on, not to mention the expense. It's going to cost enough to get the extension done, but a draft is seeping through the ill-fitting frames, and I shiver in my pyjamas as I nurse a red bush tea, the only thing I can stomach, at the kitchen table. I'm exhausted after spending all night tossing and turning and worrying about Mum and that man who calls himself Glenn Davies. I don't want you to get into trouble on our account, I say, as Mum walks into the room. She has a handful of clothes in her arms. I haven't even had the chance to talk to her about how she got on with Alan Hartle yesterday. Can I use the washing machine? She asks. I'm running out of things to wear. Thank goodness I brought an extra pair of shoes with me. Can't believe my favourite sandals are broken. Give them to me and I'll fix them, says Tom, standing up and taking his empty plate and cup to the sink. He's got his paint-splattered jeans on with holes in the knees. He wants to make a start in the little bedroom. I know it's his way of trying to get me excited about the baby and the house again, to try to take my mind off everything else. I can't bear to admit to him that I'm feeling less and less at home here with each passing day. My phone vibrates next to me, and my dad's number flashes up on the screen.
Did your mother get home in the end?
It's the first thing he says when I answer. Yes. I glance at Mum, who looks up at me. She lost her phone. It's all okay. I don't want to worry him by mentioning that Mum got assaulted and threatened on her way home. Is that your dad? Can I speak to him? She says, getting up and taking the phone from me before I've even replied. She cups it to her ear. Ewan? Yes, it's me. She wanders out of the room and into the hallway so that I can no longer make out what they're saying. Rude, I say to Tom. And we laugh uneasily as he slides into the chair next to me. She returns 5 minutes later and hands me back my phone. She doesn't tell me what they talked about. Instead, she makes herself a cup of tea and joins us at the table. I've had an idea, she announces. I think we should go to Spain. You can stay with me for a while. I nearly spit out my tea. You're joking. I don't think it's safe to stay here. But what about our jobs? And Gran, we can't just leave. There are nursing homes in Spain, she says. We can take Gran too. If we go, says Tom pragmatically, all our problems will still be here when we get back. We can't run away, Lorna. That's the trouble with Mum. She spent her whole life thinking it's the answer to everything. What exactly is she running from this time? Is there something she's not telling me?
Mum fills me in on her visit to Alan Hartle as I'm driving us to visit Gran. Tom has stayed at home with Snowy to guard the cottage, saying he's going to strip the wallpaper in the little bedroom. A sadness passed across Mum's face when he said it. She'd remembered the wallpaper. It had been hers when she was little, a link to the past. As we were leaving, I made sure to give Tom D.S. Barnes's number, just in case there's any sign of Davies lurking around the house. When I get home later, I'll call him myself to report what happened to Mum. Davies can't get away with attacking women in the street. So I think Sheila Watts stole Daphne Hartle's identity. I'm sure the woman who lodged with your gran is one and the same. And she lied to Gran. She shrugs. I don't know. We could try asking her about it when we get there. Anyway, I've asked your dad to see what he can find out about Sheila Watts and Daphne Hartle. I've already asked him about Sheila, I say, explaining about the file and how I'd found Neil Lewisham's name on an article relating to a different case. We need to go to the police, really, I say, knowing Mum won't agree. D.S. Barnes might be able to sort all this out. Who is Davies working for and what does he know? She says. Ugh, it's a mindfuck. Mum? Well, I'm sorry, but it is. And trying to get anything from Gran is like pulling teeth. It's raining hard. The windscreen wipers on my Mini squeaking as they work overtime. I've had to crank up the heating because I could see Mum shivering in her thin jacket. She refused to borrow any of my or Tom's raincoats. Her dark curls, so like mine but shorter, have frizzed. When we arrive, Gran is sitting in her usual chair by the glass doors that overlook the garden. I think, as I always do, that she must miss pottering around in her greenhouse, tending her radishes and planting bulbs in her allotment. The sound of the rain drumming on the Velux windows, coupled with the tropical heat, gives the room a cozy feel. She's wearing a green jumper I bought her for Christmas 2 years ago. In front of her is an unfinished jigsaw puzzle, the one we've done before, with the picture of the dog. Her hair is thinning and fluffs like cotton wool around her face. I feel a lurch in my heart when I see her looking so small and vulnerable, like I do every week. She smiles at Mum and me as we sit down in the chairs next to her. But it's a polite smile, the type you give strangers. Can I help you? She asks. I feel Mum tense next to me. Gran, it's me, Safi. Her eyes light up. Safi! And your daughter Lorna? Says Mum. Lolly! I wipe a tear that has seeped out of the corner of my eye, hoping nobody has noticed. I've never heard her call my mum by that name before, and I wonder if she's regressed into the past, to when Mum was a little girl. Yes, says Mum, the relief evident in her voice. She takes Gran's hands in hers. It's Lolly. I'm sorry, Lolly, says Gran, her face crumpling. I'm so sorry. Tears run down her crinkly cheeks, and my heart feels like it's going to break. Why are you sorry? Asks Mum kindly, her eyes full of concern as they flick to mine and then to Gran again. You don't have to be sorry for anything. Are the police coming back? Now, don't you worry about the police. I'll handle them, says Mum firmly, producing a tissue, magician-like, and handing it to Gran. She always seems to have one about her person, goodness knows where in her tight outfits. Gran takes it and wipes her tears away. Mum, she hesitates, throwing me a worried look.
Can I ask you if you remember a man called Neil Lewisham? Gran blinks up at Mum with her big eyes, but doesn't say anything. What about Sheila Watts? Probes Mum.
Sheila Watts?
Yes, you mentioned a Sheila before, remember? Gran turns to me, still dabbing at her cheeks.
Jean hit her over the head. Jean hit her over the head and she didn't get back up again.
Jean hit Sheila? I ask.
No, Jean hit Susan. Susan died, she says, sounding impatient now, like we should know what she's talking about.
Susan? Who the bloody hell is Susan?
Is Susan the body in the garden? I ask gently, not wanting to spook her.
I don't know if she's in the garden, she says, frowning, shredding the tissue in her hands. I don't know where they put her.
Who's they, Gran?
The people who came to take her away, of course. They weren't just going to leave her there bleeding, were they?
From the corner of my eye, I see Mum's perplexed expression.
So Susan is dead? I ask.
My stomach is clenched with anxiety. Gran's memory is like a stained glass window that has shattered. The fragments mean nothing in isolation, but everything if they were put in the right order.
Do you remember her surname, this Susan?
Wallace. Her name was Susan Wallace.
I hear Mum's sharp intake of breath. And you're saying Jean killed Susan Wallace and buried her in the garden?
Gran shakes her head, looking distressed.
No, 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 not buried her, no. But Jean hit her over the head. She hit her over the head and she died.
And this happened in 1980 when you were living in the cottage? Says Mum, leaning forwards.
I don't know.
Gran starts wringing her hands, the tissue now disintegrated in her lap.
I can't remember when it happened. It's all so foggy.
Her face creases, and then she looks at me.
Here, who's that?
She says suddenly, out of the blue, as though the conversation never took place. She's pointing at Mum. It's Lorna, your daughter, I say, my heart in my feet.
Oh, yes.
Yes. She turns away from us to look out of the rain-spattered window. I glance at Mum. I think we've lost her.